Right, this is now talk number 19 on the series about the wicked, and we're looking now at resuming the story of Rhoda and the adventures of Rhoda and the devious way in which Rhoda also used to lure people into saying critical things about other people in order that she could then use those words later for blackmail purposes. Now, this is a very common technique. It's a practice widely used by manipulators to get a hold over you by getting you to say critical or insulting things about other people. They even entice you into this by saying critical things themselves. They hope to provoke you into joining in and saying something nasty or spiteful or unworthy, which you wouldn't otherwise have said and which you will very probably later regret saying. But then they will use your own words against you, even months or years afterwards, and threaten to reveal what you said to cause you embarrassment or destroy relationships. So they may openly threaten to do so, or they may just continue to hold it over you more subtly as an unspoken threat. Now, the people who use this technique, and I can assure you it's quite common, the people who use this technique, they want you to feel that you'd better not cross them, or they'll reveal what you have said. They want you to feel that and to fear that. And they use this blackmail technique. Blackmail is the right word for it, and because it's a form of menace. They use this technique to prevent you from exposing them or giving evidence against them at work or church or anywhere else. And I've come across this technique many times. I don't think it's happened more times in my life. It's just that I've had occasion to discover it and uncover it and address it, because I've been in positions where it was my duty to uncover things. But other people who don't go around trying to investigate and uncover things, they just don't discover them. It doesn't mean it's not happening. It just means you're not perhaps uncovering it. So I've come across this technique at any rate many times when I've been trying to persuade employees to open up and tell me what they know about a wrongdoer. But they fear to speak, and in part they fear it because of what might then be revealed about the things they have said about other people in the past. But it's not only in a work context that this happens. It's also just in a private context, and where even just between individual A and individual B, individual A will exert pressure or blackmail over B because of the fear on B's part that A might reveal what B has said about C, and that gives A a hold over B. At any rate, it's yet another of the many reasons why we should avoid gossip. Because if you don't, the likelihood is that you will get trapped in this way. And I think in my experience, this device has mainly been used by women to gain control over other women, since they are more prone to talking to and about each other. Men talk more often about issues and things and events and machinery and cars and things, whereas women talk much more about other people. However, nobody is immune from this. So whoever you are, you need to know that the words you speak today about other people may be used later against you. So beware of what you say, especially to people who seem to want you to say things about others. And if someone wants you to say things about person C, it's likely that they want to gain some kind of control over you. But even if it's not their express purpose at the time, that the person to whom you're speaking will remember your words later and may very well make use of them in this way. Therefore, the next time you feel the urge to say something sarcastic or resentful or cutting or cruel or unkind about another person, stop yourself. Firstly, it would be wrong to do it in itself. It's inherently wrong. But secondly, you may also be putting ammunition into someone's hands, which they can then use against you later when the need arises. But also, I would say this, be particularly wary about this if you find that you have you suddenly feel a strong urge to say or reveal something, where that urge seems to be coming from nowhere. If that happens, and it does happen to people, the chances are that you're being subjected to some kind of mind control. That is, someone is inducing you to do their will and to reveal information that they can then use, either against others or against you. And I've experienced that kind of bewitching numerous times. You feel a spontaneous urge to say something or reveal something which you hadn't intended to say. It may be something which you know, even at that moment, you ought not to say. Even so, the urge to say it can be very strong. Now, this kind of mind control is an aspect of witchcraft, and whenever it occurs, you must resist it with all your will. But also, say to yourself, as it's happening, why did I just feel the sudden urge to say that? What's happening here? And then ask yourself whether somebody somewhere may be exercising some kind of mind control over you. And if so, who is it and who might they be? Now, the most obvious candidate is the person that you're with and speaking to at that moment. They've got the most to gain and the clearest opportunity. So if that's the case and you do find yourself suddenly feeling the urge to reveal things to this person, person B or whatever they are, begin to check out person B and be extremely careful as to what else you say to person B from then on. But however, it may not necessarily be that person that you're with that's causing this, that's having this effect on you. It could be another person who's exercising mind control over you from afar. And I'll speak more about mind control in a later book that I do on the subject of witchcraft. But it's an important issue, and wherever you feel that, at any rate, for now, just resist it. Don't give in to it. Don't reveal information. Let me say a little more now about Rhoda and how Rhoda refused to cooperate with the Matthew 18 procedure. And let me say a little bit about the Matthew 18 procedure, which is for resolving conflicts. Now, because Rhoda was a married woman, I began by speaking to her husband Stephen, and I asked for a meeting with Rhoda, with Stephen present, to discuss what exactly she'd been saying about people and why she'd been saying it. And that is the first stage of what I call the Matthew 18 procedure, Matthew chapter 18. And here it is, Matthew 18 verses 15 to 17. It says, "If your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. If he listens to you, you have gained your brother. But if he does not listen, take one or two others along with you, that every word may be confirmed by the evidence of two or three witnesses. If he refuses to listen to them, tell it to the church. And if he refuses to listen even to the church, let him be to you as a Gentile and a tax collector." Now that last line simply means put him out of the church. Let him cease to be part of the church, your church, the local church. Now, Rhoda had no intention of cooperating with any part of that procedure, and she made various excuses and refused to meet us. And then, as I've mentioned in the last talk, about 2 months later, she suddenly announced that she did want to meet with us after all. But as I explained last time, it was only to try to cause trouble, not to make any genuine attempt to hear our concerns, let alone to resolve them. Now, if you're a sincere person and you're genuinely trying to deal with someone's misconduct, their refusal to engage in the Matthew 18 procedure is in itself helpful guidance to you about their real nature. And their refusal to meet up strongly suggests guilt, unless they can offer some compelling reasons for refusing. But by contrast, if they are willing to meet with you, and if they listen sincerely to your concerns and take real steps to resolve them, then they're probably a genuine person with whom you can do business. But if they refuse to meet, or they won't cooperate when you do meet, the chances are you are dealing with someone false and probably wicked. So the very conduct or not of the procedure, the very willingness to engage in it, is guidance. But let me talk now about an incident involving another couple called, I'm giving the name Philip and Sonia. Now this is a situation where we felt there was no point in going through the Matthew 18 procedure. So I mention this because it's rare, but now and again it happens. There are rare situations where a wicked person says that they want to meet with you, supposedly under the Matthew 18 procedure, but you feel it would be pointless or even harmful to meet with them. And I can think of such a situation involving Philip and Sonia. And a number of us in that church had decided that their behaviour was so bad that we would need to insist on Philip standing down as an elder, and probably more realistically, we'd need to ask both of them to leave the church. They'd have to be expelled, if necessary, as members, because they were such a malignant influence. Now, that could, in theory, have all been dealt with under the Matthew 18 procedure, under such a meeting or series of meetings. However, a number of us discussed it, and we felt there'd be no point in it. We'd already had various discussions with them in the past, which had been completely unproductive. And we felt, I think correctly, that yet another meeting would be a pointless waste of effort with no real prospect of success. So the alternative that we chose to go for was for those of us who felt concerned at the conduct of Philip and Sonia to simply leave the church ourselves without going through what we felt would be a charade of confronting them yet again. Now, the church was only small to begin with. It was only a small church. It was small because a lot of people had left at the time of Rhoda, which was some time earlier. So by this stage, after all the departures caused by Rhoda's departure, Rhoda and Stephen, there were only about 18 of us left in the church. And so, six of us, three couples, decided to leave and start a new church, rather than even make an attempt to reform Philip and Sonia's behaviour, or remove Philip as an elder, or remove them from the church. We thought it's better that we simply go, rather than try and tackle them. Now, before we went, we did not share our concerns with any of the other church members. However, on the very day when we met with Philip and Sonia to explain our concerns and simply to tell them that we were leaving, so it wasn't a Matthew 18 type meeting, we just told them we were concerned, told them what we were concerned about, and said we were leaving. On that very day, Philip emailed the rest of the members, notifying them of our departure. Now, that was the first that any of them had ever heard of our concerns, because we'd been so discreet throughout the whole time. And then, to Philip and Sonia's surprise, almost all the other members said, without any contact from us, that they wanted to join our new church, because Philip had told them that we were setting up a new church. So we therefore had 14 members on the day when we began, so 8 of them wanted to come with us. And Philip and Sonia then asked us after this, they asked us why we had not gone through the Matthew 18 procedure with them, given that in the previous year we had complained at Rhoda's refusal to meet with us under Matthew 18. I think Sonia in particular thought this was a real sort of powerful point that she was making to expose our inconsistency and hypocrisy and so on. But I explained to them that Matthew 18 verses 15 to 17 is not an absolute requirement. That is, it's not mandatory at all times, in all circumstances, and with all people. The point is this: it requires judgment to gauge whether the person or group is reasonably likely to respond constructively. And that assessment of the situation is both necessary and reasonable, because a high percentage of people are so false, so malicious, so disruptive, that they'll turn any attempt at a Matthew 18 type meeting into a farce, and they may even use it as an opportunity to do you further harm. So imagine a situation where a person has been abused, lied to, or lied about by a person or group or by a church. They are not under an absolute obligation to use the Matthew 18 procedure, regardless of how wounded they are already, or how futile it would be, or what further damage might be caused by meeting up with the wrongdoers. So a wounded Christian and those helping them are entitled to use their common sense to discern diakrino, the nature and intentions of the other person or group. They need to decide whether such a meeting would have at least reasonable prospects of success, or whether it might result in further harm to themselves and or to others in the church. So here was the position. Philip and Sonia were making an unusual complaint, really, about our decision not to go to them and raise our concerns under Matthew 18, but simply to leave quietly instead. But the point was that we all felt that a series of meetings with them, bear in mind we'd had plenty of other meetings, a series of further meetings with them would almost certainly have been futile. It would have just used up a lot of time and energy, caused further upset to our own people, and they'd already done a lot of harm, especially to Charles, through their malice and gossip, and we all felt there was no realistic chance of them paying any genuine attention to our concerns, because they hadn't shown any genuine attention up to this point. So bear in mind, the situation didn't just arise out of nothing. There were previous episodes in the past, before this. So we'd already had several discussions with them previously in which they'd been immature, ill-tempered, unable to maintain their self-control. But more importantly, they did not listen to our advice. And this is the most important thing that concerned me. They didn't pay any attention to the evidence which we gave them about Rhoda's lies about Charles or any other such matters. On the contrary, they consistently defended Rhoda and undermined Charles. No matter how much evidence I put forward, the evidence was not of no interest to them. They simply were not interested in the evidence we were putting forward. And that's significant, because an honest person will respond to evidence and facts. If a person stubbornly resists evidence and facts and just steadfastly maintains a position in the flying in the face of all facts and evidence, you have to question the person's honesty and integrity. And that's what is what I was doing. I didn't think they were genuine, and I still don't. So we therefore felt that a lengthy Matthew 18 procedure, going through an even longer list of concerns than those we'd already spelled out to them, would have been equally useless. Nevertheless, when Philip and Sonia rebuked us for not attempting such a meeting, I made an alternative proposal to them as a concession. I said that three of the men from our group, those of us who'd left, would meet with them, and then we three men would go through our concerns with them one by one, giving them a chance to respond to us. And we said we didn't want our wives to be present. We didn't say this, but our reason was we fully expected it would turn into a nasty meeting at which Philip and Sonia's real aim would just be to attack people and undermine relationships. And that was not an entirely hypothetical concern, given what we'd just seen happen with Rhoda, which I've just been telling you about. Now, Sonia was very close to Rhoda, and Sonia and Philip wouldn't accept or take seriously anything that was said against Rhoda. Neither would they listen to or accept anything that was said in favour of Charles. Their minds were set like stone. So, at any rate, I emphasised to them when I made this offer to them, I said if we did have such a meeting, it would need to be seen as one which they had called for, not us. I also said that the purposes of it, as far as we were concerned, was to help them to understand what they had done wrongly, in our view, and why we had all left. It was not to seek to bring about a reconciliation whereby they could then be admitted to the new church that we were forming. And our firmness in excluding them from our plans for the new church was essential. We knew that they would continue to be a major problem to us, at least in the short to medium term, if they were to stay with us. We had to keep away from them. Now, of course, nobody knows for certain what might happen in the long term, and even the very worst people might one day repent, but you have to be realistic. We couldn't afford to operate on the basis of the tiny theoretical possibility that Philip and Sonia might one day repent. We needed to focus on the practical reality of the actual situation we then faced, not the hypothetical, distant, long-term future. So, after I explained our terms to Philip and Sonia, they no longer wanted to have a meeting, and they just let it drop. And so, but they still continued from that point on to malign us to others, and to oppose and obstruct us wherever they could. And in particular, when we saw them about a week later at a teaching day, a regional type thing, involving people from other churches, their behaviour was appalling at that meeting. So clearly, there was no change of heart or self-examination in the meantime. And therefore, I think our expectation that they would have badly mishandled and abused a Matthew 18 type meeting was well founded. So, next point, let me deal with someone else now. Our experiences with a lady called Julia, a selfish, devious, domineering woman who made herself a pain in the neck when we were on a bus tour of Israel some years ago. So many years ago we went on as a family on this bus tour of Israel, and on the bus was this obnoxious woman called Julia. She was very self-centered and domineering. The tour group were all Christians and were extremely patient with her, far more so than any secular group would have been. Now Julia claimed to be a Christian, but she behaved intolerably for the whole trip, and for the first few days the group suffered in silence, but by about day 6 or 7, tempers were wearing out and people were getting more vocal. And I even saw the tour manager, not the tour guide, but the tour manager, having a row with her outside the bus when I was walking to the bus, when Julia was making yet another selfish demand. So, for example, when booking the trip, she had told the tour company that she must always have the front seat across from the tour guide, or otherwise she would get travel sickness. Now they naively believed her about this, and they agreed to this, and she insisted that that be made a formal written condition of her contract with the company. So instead of us all taking turns to have the panoramic view at the front of the bus, which is quite spectacular when you have the entire windscreen, she had it all to herself for the whole trip. Yet she never once showed even the slightest sign of travel sickness, and I felt sure it was a fabrication, especially in view of the various other things that she said and did. And one particular day I saw her kill a beetle just for the sake of it. It was happily walking along the side of the path, outdoors, we weren't in the building. So this beetle was walking along a path in the open air, and some people in the tour group were admiring it. But Julia then deliberately came up and stamped on it and killed it. And she found this amusing, and she thought we would as well. And I was appalled by her. Just what would cause the heart of a person to be so wantonly destructive and cruel and wayward as that. Vicious. So I've only ever twice seen people do that, such cruel things to little creatures. But that incident was, in itself, evidence of a wicked heart. But the main problem we had with this lady called Julia, and again, what is our context? I'm speaking to you about people who purport to be in the church, and yet who do wicked things. So the main problem with her was that she was just so overwhelmingly domineering. And we pitied her poor husband. He was a mild-mannered chap, and she ruled over him with a rod of iron. And I'm not exaggerating, she used to literally whistle to him, as you might do to a dog when she wanted him to come over. She would whistle for him like he was a sheepdog. And I used to wince when I heard her doing this, and also at the supine way in which he obeyed her commands. And another thing, early in the tour, we were in the hotel dining room, and we were unfortunate enough to be seated on Julia's table. And Julia was being very forceful in conversation, because she could tolerate no view other than her own. And her husband and most of the group chose to just let her have her own way all the time. They thought it was much easier just to agree with everything she said. But I decided not to. I refuse ever to be controlled or dominated by people. That's not the same as accepting the orders, the lawful orders and instructions of a boss or manager. That's a different matter. I'm talking about being controlled or dominated by others who have no legitimate basis to instruct me or give me orders. And so as a matter of principle, I refuse ever to succumb to this or to bow to it. So when she was just forcefully dominating the table. I stood up to Julia at the dining table, and by which all I mean is I simply disagreed with her. Now, she couldn't cope with that and lost her temper simply because I was disagreeing with her at the dining table. And she stormed off to her room. And as she left, I saw her. She paused to look round to see if her husband was coming after her, because she expected him to run after her. But somehow on this occasion, something must have been in the drinking water or something, but he had the confidence not to do it, and he stayed at the table with the rest of us. She went off to the bedroom, and he stayed with us, and we had a very pleasant dinner after that in her absence. And it's a sad testimony to Julia that the atmosphere was utterly transformed by her departure. Now, from then on, Julia bore a strong grudge towards me because I disagreed with her at the dining table, and she used to give me dagger looks. But the most disturbing thing was that towards the end of the tour, Julia manoeuvred herself into a situation where she could be alone with our children, because we had our kids on the trip. They were aged 13 and 11 at the time. And while we were not present, she manoeuvred and got the chance to talk to them. She got them on her own, on their own, away from us and away from the other tour participants. And she tried to create division between our kids and us by asking her how they felt about us as parents, and by trying to plant resentful thoughts in their minds. Now, that's what she was hoping to achieve. It didn't work, because our kids were already wary of her, like the rest of the people on the bus. They had eyes and ears. They'd formed their own view of Julia. All they wanted to do, when she'd cornered them, they just wanted to escape. So they came straight over to us to tell us what Julia had been saying about us, and the intrusive, sinister questions she'd been asking them. And they were a bit shaken by it. They felt they'd been accosted by a wicked witch, which was pretty much what had happened. Now, later we were able to laugh about it with them. And if ever the kids were dissatisfied with me, I'd say, well, you can always go and live with Julia if you like. And it formed one of those lifelong memories of a shared experience which can strengthen a family. So Julia's scheme backfired, that little trick, but not for lack of trying. She wanted to cause harm to our kids. And we learned later from the tour organisers that they had actually written to Julia to say that she would never be allowed on any future tours with their company. Now, that was the first time in history they'd ever had to ban anyone. Now, this is the point. The point is that this woman claimed to be a Christian. She was part of a church. She used all the language that Christians use. She used to read the Bible. She knew quite a bit about it. But she was one of the most wicked people I've ever met in a church context. And interestingly, even the tour organizer, later, when he was speaking of her, because we contacted the company just to complain about her, when he was speaking about her, he used the very word wicked when describing her. And he'd already formed that view before he ever heard from us. Now, the final story in this section, let me tell you about another person I considered to be wicked. I've given this man the name Jeremy. Now, he was a tour guide, and this happened in Israel. And he claimed to be a messianic believer. He was an American Jew who claimed to be a messianic believer. That means a Jew who believes in Jesus, Yeshua, as Messiah. But in my opinion, he was dishonest and devious and false. Now, I've been to Israel many times, and I've met many tour guides, and they've all been excellent, with just one exception. This man, whom I'm calling Jeremy. Now, he claimed to have been a believer in Jesus Christ for about 40 years, since he was a young man. But I concluded that he was false, and at the very least that he was dishonest. And I had grave doubts as to whether he was really born again, because he seemed to show no signs of having grown in his character or conduct since his alleged conversion over 40 years ago. So it wasn't so much that he did anything spectacular, but there were a number of small actions and incidents that caused me to conclude that he was wicked. So, for example, when we stayed at hotels, the tour guide always gets a free room, plus breakfast and a full three-course dinner. That's all free of charge for him. It's all part of the package for the tour guide. The rest of us obviously have to pay. But when we got to one particular hotel, which was especially nice, one of the more plush hotels, and more expensive therefore, Jeremy invited his wife to meet him at the hotel and to stay over, but he did that without informing the hotel and without paying anything for her to use the room or to eat in the restaurant. So I was less concerned about him bringing her to the room, because it didn't, technically speaking, cost the hotel anything for her to stay at the hotel that night. Having said that, the fact remains that she was meant to pay, and she would have had to pay if she'd stayed anywhere else, or if they had told the hotel she was there. So the hotel lost the payment that she would and should have made. But what concerned me far more was that he sneaked her into the restaurant in the evening, and again the next morning, as if she was just part of our large tour group. Now, the hotel staff didn't check all of us, all our identities, each evening and each morning. They operated on trust that we were part of the tour group. So she got free breakfast, free dinner, and that would have been worth at least £40 or 60 United States dollars. And if they'd been honest and paid for her, that's what they would have had to pay. So what I also found surprising was that Jeremy was completely relaxed about this. He spoke openly to the tour group about the fact that he was sneaking his wife in without paying for her. And he wasn't ashamed. He wasn't ashamed to speak about it. And it was obvious that he'd done it before and that he regularly did it. And it plainly didn't matter to him that what he was doing was dishonest. But it didn't seem to matter to him either that God will one day judge him for his actions. And therefore I felt, well, he clearly has no fear of God at all, at least not in this regard. But secondly, another thing that this fellow Jeremy did was that he was speaking to us one day about how his wife is observant of the kosher dietary rules. She's Jewish, obviously, as well. Therefore, she doesn't eat dairy products with meat at the same time, and so on. She observes the requirements of kosher cooking. Now, Jeremy himself is not observant. He doesn't worry about such rules. Now, that in itself, I'm not commenting on this. I'm not bothered what he does or doesn't eat. Each of them are free to do whatever they want. The point is this. Jeremy told us that when he does the cooking at home, he breaks the kosher rules by putting milk or cream into the pan along with meat and so forth. He does various things to break the kosher rules, but without telling his wife. Therefore, she is unaware that he's causing her to break the kosher laws. Now, the reality is that the law of Moses is no longer in operation. It ended when Jesus died. Therefore, there's nothing to break. It's not in operation. But that's not the point. The issue is that he was deliberately deceiving his own wife about something which mattered a great deal to her. So even if he doesn't choose to be observant himself, the point is he's deceiving her. And if he's willing to lie to her about that, then he'd be equally willing to lie to her about other things. And he'd also be willing to lie to other people. Indeed, he proved that when he deceived the hotel and umpteen other hotels in the past. The third point about Jeremy, these are just the things I observed on this tour. We were telling Jeremy one day about another Jewish tour guide that we know who has become a believer in Jesus, a messianic Jew. And when we said this, his immediate response, and this is interesting and important, his instant response was to say, she's probably just saying she's become a messianic believer to get tour groups to give her bigger tips. That's what he said. Now note this, when somebody makes an accusation against another person, especially if it bursts out of them instantly, without thought, without time, you need to take careful note. Because if a thing bursts out of a person instantly like that, they're probably just saying whatever is in their own heart. So that is, the wicked person simply imputes to other people whatever he himself thinks or does. So when Jeremy spontaneously attributed a dishonest motive to the other tour guide, to me at least, he was inadvertently revealing that he himself only pretends to be a messianic believer to impress tour groups and to get bigger tips. Now, that's an important indicator that you need to be alert to, because it can give you useful insights into the real nature and character of the one making the accusation, the allegation. And don't waste those clues. You need every indicator you can get if you're going to maximize your discernment. But fourthly, in terms of why did I think that Jeremy was false and even wicked, Each of those indicators I've just given, the first three there, they also matched my overall gut feeling about Jeremy, and also tallied with the fact that he'd never prayed out loud, or worshipped, or read from the Bible, or given any original or personal insight from his own alleged spiritual life. Now bear in mind, he's a tour guide, and he's going around telling you all about Israel, but everything he said was all just something from books. It was never nothing personal, never. None of his own spiritual insights of his own at any time. But he was also snappy and short-tempered, and he showed no evidence of sanctification. And so, if he had truly become a believer over 40 years earlier, as he claimed, it hadn't, by that stage, had any impact on his character, his conduct, or his ethics. So, to summarise, I've just given you a few examples of some of the many people I've come across in churches, underline the words, in churches, that behave like this, that speak and act and think like this. And so we're going to go on in subsequent talks in this series to look much more closely about what goes on in churches. But what I'm trying to do at this stage is to underline and seek to get you to see this broad fact, this broad truth, that wickedness is there to be found in the church. And if you're of the view that it can't be found there, that it'll never be there, that you never need to be wary of it there, you never need to look out for it there, then you're seriously misdirecting yourself, and you're going to make errors, big errors, in your judgments of situations and people. Okay, that's the end of that talk.